Yeah, everyone. My name is Eleanor MacDonald, and I welcome you to Mob Dreaming Up, Yarning Sick, Disabled Realities. This is a group yarn with a bunch of mob all around the country, and we're talking about the realities of being disabled and sick within the colony from the perspective of mob in all our lived experiences. So I'm Eleanor. I'm Paradar. I'm a mob from the southeast coast of Tjuwana slash Lutjewita, that's Tasmania, to the rest of you. And I've struggled with a lot of illnesses and the inaccessibility that comes with my disabilities for a long time now, and it's something I feel very deeply about, which is why I was so honoured to be able to help create this show and invite everyone that's here today on it. So, Tabitha, if you want to introduce yourself.
So, everyone, my name's Tabitha, or as my ancestors know me, Gudin Minya. I'm a Gudjitjmara woman born and raised and currently living on Kaurna country. I'm a formerly incarcerated woman, having spent almost 2 years in Adelaide's prison for deviant women and a cumulative 2 years on home detention. I'm still tethered to the state on parole for a further 2.5 years. And I suffer significant mental illness, namely major depressive disorder, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress. And in fact, it was my illness that led me to both my offending and subsequent incarceration, as well as those illnesses being exacerbated, worsened by the carceral state. And I also have chronic illnesses that I manage day to day. Thanks for having me.
Hey everybody, I'm Renee. I'm a Birrawhai Dangari woman on Wadawurrung country. I was raised on my country and then spent a long time going everywhere else. I finally reached a diagnosis a few years ago. I've got something called ankylosing spondylitis, and another thing called psoriatic arthritis. A bunch of autoimmune diseases and mental health issues, major depressive, post-traumatic, a bunch of other things. They like to travel in pairs, so I'm just happy to get my lived experience out into the world and share it with people. So, and also I feel it's really important that other people, especially Aboriginal women, find that support within their culture as well. So wherever I can do that, I will.
Hey everyone, I'm Molly. I'm a Wiradjuri woman and I'm living on Ngunnawal Ngambri country in Canberra right now. But I was raised and grew up in Moranbah, which is Bundjalung country. I live with several autoimmune diseases, including hidradenitis, which is a skin condition, suspected Crohn's, and a lot of gastro issues, as well as inflammatory arthritis. Yeah, I have lived experience of both disability and caring for my mum, who's also an Aboriginal woman who was killed by medical negligence, and has definitely caused both her and myself quite complex trauma and PTSD around the healthcare system.
Hi, I'm Samia, and I'm a Bundjalung Gifebal woman, and I was actually born in Canberra, and I was removed from my mother and spent a lot of time in institutions and juvenile justice too, and on the streets pretty young. I've had an eventful life, good and bad. Since I was very young, I had a diagnosis of Crohn's, so very ill for a lot of my 20s and 30s, long periods in hospital, very long periods in hospital. I also now have secondaries, which is arthritis and some neurological autoimmune dysfunction. And I have bipolar affective disorder too, and post-traumatic stress syndrome. And currently, I'm recovering from a nightmare of a broken back and mistreatment, and then resulting in negligence at the hospital that resulted in shoulder surgery and further negligence that resulted in being in intensive care with acute liver failure, all caused by the hospital. And so I've become pretty much completely disabled and can't walk properly and sometimes can't word find, and I now can't work anymore. And we were just talking, the hospital is completely lying about it, covering up their tracks. And the reason I got poisoned was because they did an incorrect discharge report with someone else's name, information, medications, etc. So they gave me the wrong medication, which nearly killed me. So I'm having a really fun time, not. Yeah.
Oh, it's me. I'm Hannah Murphy Walsh. I'm from Central Victoria, basically. Stumped at where to begin describing myself. I mostly operate as a deaf person in this world, but I do have a number of other congenital abnormalities and various health conditions that I think add up to one disabled person.
Yeah, well, I didn't say my conditions at the beginning, but basically I have endometriosis, fibromyalgia and gastroparesis, for which I currently have a semi-permanent feeding tube medical device to keep me alive, which was a very long process to obtain, and which I nearly didn't obtain in time because the medical system refused to believe that I was sick and that I couldn't just force myself to eat, in inverted commas. And as a result, I have post-traumatic stress disorder from the trauma of battling doctors who just didn't give a shit. So, yeah, we all have a lot of really important and horrible and, what's the word, I guess? Well, yes, important experiences, I can't think of the right word, that are not heard enough, and that's something I'm so excited to yarn about today, because so often how illnesses and the reality of being Black in the colony intersect are just not acknowledged or even talked about enough, even within communities. So I'm really happy that we can do this today. And I think I want to start with talking about the ways in which we are locked out and cut off from the support and connections we need. I don't know who wants to start, so I might just share a bit more about my experience. For example, the racism, even as someone who is white passing, fair, I have red hair, you know, Eurocentric appearing features, it didn't, within the medical system, it didn't matter. Although I, of course, acknowledge that mob who are of darker skin are also discriminated explicitly for that reason, because of the racism within the colony. But I can only speak from what I know of it. And even with my fairer skin, the racism I experienced within medical spaces and the medical industrial complex more widely has been horrific, and I wish I could just escape to country and live there for the rest of my life and never have to go into a medical space again. No doctors, no nurses.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry.
No, you go.
Oh, I just wanted to mention that one of my first experiences of going to an Aboriginal health centre was really impacted by a white person's view of how, because I just expect to walk in there, because when I grew up, you know, we had all of my extended family were there. You know, you could walk down the street and say people would know who you are, or, you know, you'd know their cousin or whatever. And I walked into this Aboriginal health centre having just moved interstate and knowing no one, and they were like, asking me for, you know, where's my paperwork? And I'm like, well, nobody's ever asked me for my paperwork before. So already, you know, I'm walking in the door and I'm getting these boundaries and these walls put up of, I'm already reluctant, you know, to go in there. And because it's having to deal with that, you know, that history that you have of medical stuff, and then to be put with that, I was really taken aback. So I think that put me on the back foot already.
Yeah, for sure.
And that was, you know, I was like 12 years old or something, and I remember being 12 and having panic attacks. I've got a kid that's that age. And I'd had an experience of I was home alone and the cops knocked at the door and came in and raided my house when I was there alone at, you know, 11 or 12 years old. And I remember just sitting on the couch just feeling like I was going to die because I was just so panicked about this. And then, yeah, in this new place where I didn't have access to, I didn't have that extended network anymore, so I couldn't, you know, just go down the road and talk to someone. Or, and so, yeah, I'm having this really intense thing that I wanted to reach out and get help with, and then already those barriers are up from, and, you know, I remember, and Marley, I have a similar experience in that caring for somebody, you know, from the age of 10 or 11, I was caring for an adult. So, you know, it's hard enough for grown, powerful, you know, empowered women to go out there and do it. I can't imagine how this little girl would have been able to do it. But, yeah, it really was a case of, like, if you haven't got your piece of paper saying you're an Aboriginal and the government says you're an Aboriginal, you're not welcome here. And just, yeah, I don't think I've ever had that experience if I've walked into a room full of mob and had people there that no one's ever said to me, like, can you show me your paperwork? You know, can you show me that you belong here and that you access that, that you can access this community?
And that's the thing I find with mainstream health services and hospitals is they play gatekeeper. I found that even, you know, coming home from prison where I was released onto parole under mental health orders, I needed to access my medication. And I went to the chemist with the scripts my doctor had prepared, which had closed the gap on them as part of the Close the Gap scheme. And I'm a fair-skinned woman as well. And immediately he said to me, well, where's your card? And I said, what card? And he saw your card that says you're Aboriginal. So I'm, for us, we don't do those these days. So there's me coming home from a really traumatic 2 years inside where you absolutely brutalised and have subpar healthcare, if you could even call it healthcare, coming out on mental health orders, not being able to access my medication. And, you know, he refused to give me my medication until he could get in contact with my doctor to confirm that I was Aboriginal. Like, and it's this stuff that these organisations do, right, about gatekeeping, and there's this whole rhetoric in the health system about self-managing your illnesses and, you know, sort of putting that responsibility on us. But we've almost got to go cap in hand begging for this stuff from followers these days, you know? And it's that impacts us and impacts your health. Yeah,
the card line, I tell you. I'm married to a white fella, and so I send him in, and I've had people looking over his shoulder like, where is she? You know, where is this brown person that you're supposed to be caring for? I had, you know, even people who work at the pharmacy. And, you know, if you're coming from, medical trauma is another layer on top of this that, you know, Tabitha, you've coming from this prison, you know, a literal prison, and trying to take care of yourself from that. And then being met with that, and the gatekeeping is—it seems to be everywhere in the medical community. I've taken my children in and into a specialist, and you know, I'm sure you guys have had it happen where they don't ask you the question if you identify; they choose that answer for you. And, you know, that's one of the most insulting things for me, that you don't get to choose that answer. I I get to identify, and especially I know maybe some of you might relate to it, that because you can pass as white, I find that it's more important to introduce my culture into that situation, because for me it's like they win if you don't say, this is what I'm entitled to, this is what you're giving to me, this is what you need to do for me. You know, it's like forcing their hand into doing that.
Yeah.
It really is. It really is some kind of motivation to keep Black followers off of their list somehow. Every time I have to call into the hospitals around here, which is a nightmare already, they always just go ahead and assume, like when they're doing that check off of, you know, these are your details, please confirm or deny, they always just go, they always just automatically say, oh, you're not Aboriginal, despite the fact that it should be on my file somewhere. And the fact that if I physically walk in, like it is 50-50, they will definitely have to ask. It's so blatant that they just don't want to think about it. They don't want us to be there.
They feel like it's pandering.
One of the consequences, if you finally get that, oh yes, you are Aboriginal, and then they start looking at you and going, but like, how can I be sure? Because I've got this essentialized idea, and if you're saying you are, then you must be lying to me. And so everything you say after this, I'm not going to believe you, because you've lied to me from the beginning, and I'm never going to listen to anything you say, because you said you're Aboriginal, and I've been taught this essentialized idea from media, from school, from my own family, and so I'm just not going to listen to you.
It's so loaded too, that whole behind that is not just, I don't think you look like an Aboriginal. It's like, I don't think you deserve this treatment. I don't think you should access this healthcare. I don't think you should get this, you know, and it's so loaded with all this even unconscious bias that they have towards Aboriginal people. That, you know, I remember being in pain all night, one night, because I didn't get diagnosed for a long time. I had a lot of other symptoms that sort of just happened and got worse and worse and weren't managed because I wasn't getting treatment. But, you know, standing in this dentist's office begging them to see me because I was in so much pain, and them saying to me, like, oh, no, you have to pay the $20 to get in or whatever it was. I didn't have the $20, man. But, you know, I just didn't have it. And trying to beg them and say, you know, but I'm an Aboriginal, that means I get free treatment here. You know, it's not that. And, you know, him arguing back and forth, this person with me. And in the end I said to him, like, do I have to come in a bloody lap and with my face painted or some crap? Like, is that what level do I have to meet of it to be able to access this thing? And I think, Hannah, was it you that said that I'm just rambling. But, you know, it's a mental block that they add to that access, that you know when you go in there you're going to have to face that and you're going to have to deal with that,
and that you're not worth that care, the moral failing. I mean, the thing that's, oh no, you go, Tabitha.
I was just going to say that moral failing stuff is like that in prison. So for mob inside, we don't have access to Medicare funded health services. So for example, you know, we know that something like 90% of women who are in prison present having had mental illnesses or active mental illness. We don't have access to Medicare funded psych services, so there's no access to psychiatrists and psychologists and counselling, and they act then as gatekeepers. So when we go in and we're upset and we're, you know, right at the end of it, you might be having a little bad PTSD stuff and not sleeping. When we go in as Black women, we're seen as difficult, hard to manage, not able to look after ourselves, attention seeking. And actually they pathologize us when really they should be looking at the system and going, you know, we know that this person
exactly
we know what the statistics say about mob entering prison. I mean,
yeah,
the reality in this country is that people with a mental illness comprise a disproportionate number of people who are arrested, who come before courts and who are imprisoned. And yet we've got nothing to support them because, again, the system gatekeeps, even when they've got us behind their gates.
Yeah.
We just can't be in this country.
And, I mean, I didn't realise until I had to engage with the medical space as a, as they call it, a complex patient. The moment you don't have a broken leg or something that can slap a Band-Aid on, you're a complex patient. I didn't realise how easy it was for them to cut you off and say, we're just not going to do it. With my gastroparesis, it means the stomach is partially paralysed. It just, the food sits there. It doesn't get moved down very well into the next stage of digestion. And I nearly died from it. I became very, by the time I had a tube placed, I was about a week away from death. But even that, even saying that within the medical system, oh, no, you weren't. But I was, because mentally and physically, my body had had enough. I'd been battling for 2.5 years to even get the diagnosis of gastroparesis, let alone the nutritional care. And I remember a really horrible memory before I finally got diagnosed in Nam, Melbourne. I was at the hospital back in Tijuana, and care outside of the major cities is just abominable in hospitals. There's nothing. I was desperate. I was like, I can't eat. I can't, like, there's nothing I can do. I can't put more in, and I'm barely eating and I'm barely drinking. And I'm ending up in here every month from dehydration and malnutrition. And my parents were there, and they were so hopeful. They were saying, surely, I mean, you're so sick, you need that care. Yeah. And the doctors came in and they said to me, you just need to try harder. You know, you're not doing it hard enough. You know, you can get it in. You're just not trying hard enough. And the thing that sticks with me the most that day is seeing my mum in tears, because she thought I was going to get that help. And because she's a nurse herself, and she herself is within that system, and she thought, despite how hard it is, I was that bad that surely I'll get care. And they just didn't. They didn't care. I'm only here today because I had a doctor who is an expert in the field of the gut conditions that I have. And if I hadn't seen him, I wouldn't be here today. And even that acknowledgement, the medical system doesn't even want to admit. And care, every time I go in, it's a battle. If it's anything more complex than, oh, you know, I have an infection or something, I just need antibiotics. Yeah. It's every single time. It's the same back and forth. I had to go to the hospital today to pick something up, but I realised it last night that I had to go home and I had to pick something up, and I just started crying because just the space of hospitals alone, that impersonal, they don't care. And if they don't want to offer you care, they're not going to offer it. It doesn't matter if you're about to die or you're already dead. They're not going to take responsibility. And I think
it's a mob in the colony, isn't it? Constantly having to appeal to the coloniser, and these sort of medical institutions for our own humanity are basic human rights which are documented by the UN. Yet every day when you front up at hospital or at these medical places, you've got to beg for that.
Yeah.
It's no different to us having to go for our flour and sugar now. It's and now
sugar.
Insulin and Ventolins and medical treatments.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's just, and the constant drain that puts on you, and the mental strain, and then having to go back home and trying to, you know, be something for your community as well.
Yeah.
While also battling all this. And then you think you can, I think this is something Hannah can speak to. sorry, Hannah, the moment of panic there. But I think you can speak to it, is you're facing all of this. So surely, you know, mob were disabled before colonisation, mob were disabled during colonisation, mob were disabled on the missions, mob were disabled everywhere. So you think surely there must be some kind of network of support to help disabled people, but you go and look for it and doesn't exist. And you were talking about it the other day, Hannah, and I think you spoke really well on it, if you want to.
Yeah, no, it's really stark, actually. I think as an adult with disabilities, Because, I mean, I was a disabled kid. Like, I was literally born with a hole in my head. So, like, right from the beginning, it was sort of very clear that I had to be fairly abled. Like, I could be different. Different is fine. Different is very accepted. But not being able to physically match up to other people is still scary. There's still, like, a lot of fear that I think there's a lot of fear of the sick person, but there's also a lot of fear of the consequences of what sickness, perceived sickness can bring. And I have, like, a lot of my childhood stories, I'm like, this is a funny story, and they're actually really traumatic. One of my funnier stories is about how, and again, I was an asthmatic from pretty much the time I left the hospital. And one of the memories that, like, sticks in my head of my father, he's stolen gin, so he just doesn't engage with government institutions. Anything he perceives as it, does not like it. And I remember once I must have been using my inhaler more than normal, just like a little ventilator puffer. And I remember him saying that it wasn't good that I was using it so many times, because I might become addicted, and when I need it later, it's not going to be there.
Mm.
And I don't know, that, like, the sort of scarcity mindset around, you know, supplies to black fellas and our health is just, yeah, like.
And that threatening of that as well, like the constant threat of you can be taken away, this can be taken away from you if you, you know, become the difficult, quote unquote, difficult black woman.
Yeah.
And I think they being most of the population, don't acknowledge that inherently black fellas come with a giant, giant, not necessarily like a mental illness, but they come with a giant lot of sorrow that they're just carrying as a people. Well, I mean, I don't think I've ever met anyone who doesn't have that, unless they're severely disconnected from their culture. I don't think that I have met one Aboriginal person that does not have that heaviness within them. And I think, you know, if you got to look at healthcare that's appropriate for us, that needs to be taken into account. And we do need to have these barriers removed, otherwise it's going to be our experiences time and time and time again, you know.
Yeah. Marley, Samia, do you want to speak to any of the stuff we've been talking about? I know your experiences have both been very traumatic, so feel free to say no. But
I do. So I'm in an interesting situation because my background started as an Aboriginal health worker when I was in my early 20s. I'm now 61. And so I've worked in health for 30, 40 years. And my most recent job has been as an associate professor teaching Indigenous studies at University of Canberra. But before that, it's all been in health, population health, public health, Indigenous health, HIV medicine, et cetera, community health. And my last job before this one was teaching Aboriginal health to medical students. And so all of the things we're talking about, I've watched over the whole of my career be issues and trying to address them and trying to make a change in the system. And even going back to, like, I can remember a time where there was nothing around collecting data for Aboriginal people accessing healthcare. And we had big, you know, promotions. This is 40 years ago, about that people needed to be able to ask those questions so that we could get proper care. This before. And now they're back. They're like, they're kicking back on us almost. So it's like, I go into hospital, like recent experience, okay, so I go in, doctor comes to me, it's on my file that I'm Aboriginal. So he says to me, oh, so what do? In this tone that's already patronising. And then he says, oh, So, like, do you have a job? And I go, oh, I'm an associate professor. Oh, attitude changes completely, 150%. Oh, you must be intelligent. Oh, okay, I need to treat you differently now. But then as soon as I start asking questions and going, well, no, you shouldn't be doing that, or actually this is the way it should be done, I'm a, like you said, angry black, difficult black, you know, having problems that shouldn't be there, thinking I should have special treatment, you know, the complex needs, probably a drug addict, she's in pain, and saying she's in pain, must be a drug addict. I heard a nurse say while I came out of recovery, and my arm was in agony, walk past and then say to another nurse, because I was saying, can they get the Aboriginal liaison? Oh, no, they're busy. And I said, can I get the social worker? Oh, well, the social worker's for other people, not for you. And then, you know, I'm going, excuse me. And then she goes off and says, I hear it at the nurse's station. She goes, oh, you know what these people are like, you know? And then now, because they've made all these errors, of course it's because I'm Aboriginal and I'm imagining it all.
Oh, yeah.
Mental health patient and I'm imagining it all.
100%.
And I've also been told, oh, but you should be going to your own services. It's about time. And I'm at the point, like you said, about being afraid to go to hospitals. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up with my mum being terrified. A lot of my generation of the stories of, you know, having your kids taken. So we had. I grew up with a lot of stories about, you know, the fear of hospitals. And after what I've just been through, which has just been like, you know, that you talked about nearly being, you know, they came into, I have shoulder surgery as a result of the negligence of going in for a different treatment that they lie about. And then I wake up in intensive care because they give me the wrong medication. And then they're standing there telling me, oh, well, you might die in a couple of days, as if I'm a piece of meat that doesn't even matter. And then I was saying to Marley, like last weekend I started vomiting again and being really scared that my liver enzymes were going bad again. And so I got a taxi to a different hospital because I was terrified to go back to the same hospital. And I got there and I sobbed and sobbed and sobbed and was having constant panic attack and just saying to myself, why have I even come here? Like, I'd be better off being dead than being here. And I was so terrified. And I'm at that point. It's like I'm terrified now to go to hospital. And I don't know what to say about it because I'm rambling a bit. But, you know, it's so interesting to have been someone who's worked in all those healthcare settings. I've been an advisor to the minister on mental health and suicide for Aboriginal people in the ACT, like on the advisory, and then I contacted them about this. None of them want to hear. None of these people want to hear. None of the complaints procedures. No one wants to hear. No one wants to do anything. So I think what is happening here, even though I didn't know it was going to happen and I was going to be a part of it, is really important because unless our lived experience starts being heard, as no one's ever going to take it seriously. Like, it has to be challenged. The system is broken, absolutely, utterly broken. And not just for us, but for the nurses and junior doctors as well. That's also, I have Aboriginal student doctors who I taught who've suicided because of the treatment they got in hospitals, you know, who've been molested by senior surgeons, you know, who are afraid to say that they're Aboriginal. Because they'll get treated differently.
The way they'll get treated.
Yeah. But then they want to take you and be the poster girl. You know, our poster girl, you know, Aboriginal doctor, and they're so groovy and they speak four languages and, you know, stand on one leg and they can do dance as well as, like, do, you know, be do surgical procedures. And guess what? They just look like white people almost, except they're black. Like, they want us to be what they want us to be, you know. And, you know, I spent all day yesterday sobbing because I feel so hopeless about the whole situation. I've just been approved for the NDIS and I came home from hospital early because I was so afraid of being in there and I was deathly ill and I live alone. I spent literally 2 weeks before someone showed up so I could even have a wash, you know?
Yeah.
And it was meant to be after hospital care, but they couldn't get it together.
Mm.
So I just sat in my same clothes. I was so sick I couldn't even make my own food. Luckily I had some friends who dropped in, but, like, people are dying.
Mm.
Yeah. And, all the way across the country, it's not just one group of people. No, it's not everyone. Just,
and that makes
it's not like us with only remote communities. Mm. We're in Canberra. Yeah. We're on Ngunnawal country. Mm. We've got the worst hospitals in the country and we're in the capital.
And, you know, sis, like, that makes me think the system isn't broken. I think the system is working exactly how it is
intended. In that way, yeah.
Because this colony is designed to erase and kill us.
Yeah.
I think that these institutions that are supposed to be health care, and that's, you know, an oxymoron, isn't it? Like, this, these institutions caring for us. I don't think they are. I think they're deliberately working as the colony needs them to. And that's a really kind of jarring thing to think, right? But you know, unless we're performing for them, you know, when you talk about the doctors and that they can also dance, exactly, they want us when we can perform for them, but when we need something, that's when we know our place.
And and you're right, because I remember, you know, Foucault, you know, without getting academic, but you know, prisons, institutions, they're all based on the same format, you know, which is power based and oppressive and
control.
So we're victims who've made ourselves sick. It's our fault, you know. If only we did the right thing, we'd be better somehow, you know. And that's how those systems work. And hospitals are based on exactly the same system as prisons, exactly the same system.
Sorry, yeah, I was going to say I find that discourse when I have been trying to get a diagnosis, it's always like, well, do you know good nutrition, Marley? Like, are you eating properly? I spent like 2 years being referred to dietitian after dietitian, just with them trying to get me to lose weight before I was able to see an Aboriginal dermatologist who was like, all of your conditions are connected. You need to see a gastroenterologist. Why has no one believed you? And it comes down to that, you know, that discourse of like, oh, you don't know how to manage yourself. You don't know how to look after yourself. And, you know, my mom dealt with this too, where one of the most insidious examples is after she died of medical negligence and we went through the coronial inquest, they changed her cause of death on her death certificate from respiratory failure and pneumonia to including chronic pain, diabetes, all that shit that was not, you know, related to the negligence that killed her. But for them, it was to paint a picture being like, oh, look.
Anything to cover up.
Your body was unruly. You weren't looking after yourself. You know, it was these things that killed you, not us.
And then I think we've got that double crossover of like being someone who's chronically ill and facing these cultural things as well that, you know, some days if you, like you guys were saying before, having to spend so much time at a hospital or going to an appointment, and for someone who's got a chronic illness, whether that's physical, mental, whatever, you just run out of energy. And then on top of that, you're forced not only to advocate for yourself as a chronically ill person, but also as an Aboriginal person on top of that. And it just, I had someone say to me recently, I had another Aboriginal person say to me, you know, oh, I went up the Northern Territory and went out on country with people and they were just so happy and so wonderful. And they said to me they didn't understand why all us mob down in the cities were all unhappy. And I said, well, mate, if I had freedom to go out on country whenever I felt like it and was surrounded by my community, I'd be happy as Larry as well. And, you know, we'd have so much more of that, those things that nourish the other part of us that is not just, you know, your gut has this inflammation or, you know, your spine is wrong with this. So if we had those things, I'd be pretty happy about that too. Like, and it's just, yeah, it's, it seems like we're running a race with no
but,
yeah.
But also the, like, the idea of, like, you know, there's this dichotomy between like the happy-go-lucky Aborigine out like in some remote location doing whatever they want, and like the urban Aborigine who's like sick, or their favorite is anxiety or a chronic presenter. I hate that that term exists. I hate that no, it exists, but it does. And I think I'm going to start to sound conspiracy theory-ish here, but I promise it's not. I think a lot of problems have come with the way, because like you said, can't remember exactly who said it first. I'm so sorry. But there's been a lot of data gathering over the last, like over the last 50-ish years. And a lot of it, like, it does not change the actual outcomes for Black people at all, because the systems themselves are so fucked up. So what happens is we see all of these statistics about, like, Black people dying young, Black people are more likely to have this disorder or this disease, or, you know, they are more likely to present in severe distress, or, you know, the popular one about alcohol, where we are less likely to drink overall, but when we do, we are more likely to be problem drinkers. And these things are used against us. They are perceived as personal faults instead of being, because the system is so geared towards the individual being responsible for the individual, that instead of, you know, seeing all of these, you know, awful gut-wrenching statistics from one particular place, or, you know, seeing just an absolute lack of information from, say, the regional and remote areas, which are so deeply underfunded. Like, how would they know they're happy? Yeah. You know? It becomes a way to obscure the bigger picture that they're actually supposed to be gathering this data for. Like, instead of fixing the problems, it instead becomes about identifying the problems and then turning it on.
Instead of actually dealing with the problem.
Like, the funny thing is, another reason why there's so many mob in the cities who are sick and they're struggling is because they have to go to get treatment. I had to come to Nam to see a doctor who would believe me, because there was nothing in Chawana. It's so underfunded. The moment you step outside of those major areas, it's just not there.
Yeah.
And another thing, Samia, when you were talking, that I often drives me absolutely, I get so angry, is a restriction in medical spaces on how you can be and how you connect. Like, you cannot, it didn't really fully be realized to me, because I'm in a lot, like, I mean, I have these complex illnesses, so I'm on a lot of Facebook groups to, like, you know, learn from other people and find out lots of things I wouldn't otherwise know. And it wasn't until I was on those groups that I realized how different the white person, and specifically the white women's, because it's often white women in these groups, what the white women's experience is. They go and they say, look, if your doctor's not listening to you, because, yes, there's also the phenomenon of doctors not listening to white women. Yeah. I mean, that's all the books we ever read. My doctor didn't listen to me, so I've written a book about it, and I've got one sentence about non-binary, queer, trans people and non-white people. One sentence covers it. Yeah. And they say, you know, you've just got to be angry. You've just got to argue with the doctor. You've just got to say it. And I have never felt more powerless or out of control than I have in medical spaces. It doesn't matter what I say. If I argue, I make it worse. They will put on my notes, she is a difficult patient. Yeah. Maybe we should call security. Yeah. I just don't get angry, because I'm protecting myself from the consequences of me being seen as that angry Black woman. If I get angry, they're going to call security, and I will have, you know, permanent notes on my file that I will never be able to erase, saying she didn't respond, she didn't listen, she was wrong. But if a white woman does it, I just don't understand. They argue and the doctor goes, oh, the white women's tears phenomenon. Oh, of course, sorry, yes, you're upset. And when a white woman is emotional, they say, oh, yes, you're upset, I understand. Well, when a Black woman is emotional, or a Black person, a non-binary person, or gender fluid person is, or if a Black man is emotional, they say, that's why you're sick. You're sick because of whatever mental thing you've got going on.
Yeah, and we can never just be angry or dissatisfied with
exactly.
Like
you're not allowed to.
You have mental health. You are psychotic, and it's like, no, I'm just actually not happy with the service I'm receiving right now. And it's that stuff, what you said, Eleanor, about them putting it in your notes and forever pathologizing us, you know. So it's like what Hannah was saying, they're looking for problems with us. So making it our individual fault that we feel this way or behave this way or have this illness, you know, it must be something our parents did or our mothers did while they were pregnant, that, you know, and it never does the mirror turn back on the state or back onto colonization about why are we in this situation? Why are we presenting really complex needs that don't just relate to health but relate to our whole way of living and everything that it means for our well-being? Why is it that, you know, I can't go back to country, okay? I can't go onto country. And for me, country is medicine. My stories are medicine. That's what's going to heal me. But what does that mean for us? Because it's only the medical system telling us what health means. They're the ones who set up all this deficit language about how many percentage of us have diabetes and how early we're going to die compared to white collars. No one ever asks me, what does it mean to be well to you, Tabs? Like, what is it going to look like? You know, we have to orbit around their notions of health and well-being, and we have to behave in the way they want us to behave as patients of their service.
I mean, this is what I'm getting to is, like, so because I've taught in those spaces decades, all of what we're talking about, I've taught, you know, about deficit discourse, about the stories beyond the statistics, what's really good, you know, all of that, how to interact with people as, you know, human beings, like what's the first thing you do with someone, you know? Well, yeah, like if you've got time, you're going to say, you know, are you Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, blah, blah, blah. Maybe, but, you know, if someone comes into intensive care, the first thing you're going to do is, you know, do what you have to do to save their lives. Doesn't matter who you are, right? But then I'll go, you know, what's the first thing you can do that is going to make a difference to a person is to actually touch them or get down to their level and tell them, you're okay, you're safe, I'm going to take care of you. Mm. Like, regardless of who you are, you know. So you can do all of this, and I've had students go, oh, I'm completely changed. I feel, you know, my whole world's opened up, and, oh, I really want to make a difference in Aboriginal health and yada, yada, yada. But, like, as soon as they walk into the hospital, that goes out the window because the system doesn't allow them to do that.
It's
systemic, and it's from the top down, you know, so they can come. I've been in hospital. This time I was in hospital, I had doctors treating me that had been my students, and they knew what I'd taught them, but there's no way they can practice that in that system because they're basically told off by senior doctors who haven't been educated in any way, behave differently, who say, oh, look, you know, just get on with it. You know, there's no time to go into anything else with them. You know, they just think they're special or whatever.
Yeah.
And that angry black thing, like I was just, when I was in hospital, so 2.5 months I was there, and the same registrar who came and said, oh, well, so you're a professor. And suddenly I was of interest because I was intelligent. You don't have intelligent blacks, educated black people. So at one point they were sending me off for all these scans, and I'm going, I said to him, oh, well, what's this scan for? Oh, we don't know. You know, we just get told that the scan's at 2 o'clock and to send you over. And I'm going, no, who ordered the scan? What's the scan for? Mm. Oh, I don't have that information. I'm going, well, you should have that information. Like, why don't you have that information? Oh, Samia, you're being difficult, you know, like, you know, and then I go, I'm health literate. Like, you know, you can, and then he goes, well, everybody has a right as a consumer to have health information. And I'm going, yes, and I'm asking you for it. And then he finally goes, I go, well, who wrote the order? And he goes, oh, Dr. So-and-so. And I go, oh, so he's the gastroenterologist, and you know that he's the gastroenterologist, right? And he goes, yeah. And I go, so that means it's for a gastro condition, doesn't it? And he goes, yeah. And I go, so you did know the information the whole time. You knew what the scan was about. You knew all of that. You know, so when...
Why aren't you willing to share?
They're making us crazy.
Yeah.
You know, they're making us like Rosalie Cunliffe Monk said, you know, we're not the problem. You know, I'm not the problem. I'm not an illness. You know, the colony is making us again and again, torturing us, us, making, I feel like I'm crazy now. And in my file, every time I go in, it's got somebody else's name, diagnosis, medications. And if I go in there unconscious, they're going to kill me. And I can't get that off my record. And it probably all of us all also will have things saying, oh, we're difficult, we're angry, we're, you know, mental health cases, you know, you've been in prison, oh, you're stolen generation. And it's like, oh, you're too complicated, don't want to deal with you.
And trying to, Tabitha, what you were saying before, trying to hold that mirror back to this day, like it's not possible. We were talking here about, you know, complaints process and things like that. I've had people, I've had the hospital close my complaints. Like just continually gaslight, continually ask for extensions. There's no accountability whatsoever.
They lie
their fucking faces off to you, and they know that they hold the power in the situation, and no one will ever believe you because you're angry, you're black, you know, you're disabled. How could I ever trust you? I've had my mum in tears be like, I was sexually assaulted by a nurse, and they were like, we changed to medications. That's what it was. Like,
changing medication does that all the time to me.
Yeah, and like even in death, I think too, like there's just no valuing of our lives whatsoever. Like,
no.
My mum didn't need palliative care. Like, you know, that's the kind of shit that we have to put up with.
Yeah.
I'm just aware of time. I think, and it's a good sort of time, I think, to move on to the sort of next, which is connected to everything we've been talking about, obviously. But I want to talk about like changing the space, and particularly the thing I found most, well, aside from the violence and trauma and sheer horror that the colony put me through, the other thing I found most devastating was the ableism and lack of even the effort to recognize our struggles by mob who aren't disabled or who aren't, you know, coming up against that every single day. Before everything started to become really, really difficult for me, I didn't fully realize how overwhelming that lack of recognition and the casual ableism within the community, which I know is driven by the colony, but the fact that mob will still, even after being told how damaging some of those things can be, will continue speaking and continue acting because I don't know why, but it's just, it's one of the most devastating things to me. I've tried to speak against it, and I've had to sit there and listen to mob debate trigger warning for eugenics against disabled people. But I've had to sit and listen to mob debate in front of me, knowing I was disabled. The eugenics of if I had a disabled baby, I'd kill it. And then I'm going, well, I'm disabled and I have a pretty full life. What makes you think you can decide that? Well, you're different, you know. You've just got X, Y, and Z, you know. It's not the same. And then why do you think that's an appropriate thing to say? Well, I just, it's devastating how when I want to connect with community across the country and I want to talk about my experiences, they're either ignored, completely lost, or I log on to different social media spaces every day to see mob across the country and what they're up to. So much of what they post is just not thinking about the disabled or ill experience at all, which to me is just so bizarre because when you look at the statistics, over half of us, and I'm sure it's way more, but all mob who know other mob know, I'm sure, at least five people within their lives who have an illness or are disabled or do care work or are themselves involved in care work. And the fact that this lack of space exists, I mean, what about the rest of you? How have you found that within, not just, I mean, I'm not talking about individual communities here, but like on more national scales as well.
Yeah.
And when you've spoken to mob across the country on social media or met them at various, you know, events or institutions or things like that.
I don't want to ramble on more than I already have. But even things like not making community events accessible.
Oh, that's my, I hate that.
It's like, I need at a minimum, I need wheelchair access.
Right.
I need a toilet. Mm. And
lift access?
Yes. I need somewhere comfortable to sit. Like, this is just bare minimum.
Mm.
And I've had the feeling before of people going like, oh, you know, they're already acknowledging us. Just, you know, don't push it too much. Otherwise, they won't give us anything. It's like, for me, it's all or nothing in all spaces, you know. And I think it's more about us having to, other people having to take up our plight, I think, more than anything. Getting everyone.
Yeah, and realizing how deep it goes. I think, and I think it's most, like, most crucially, the most could give so much more insight and give us so much more power to speak back if we actually recognise the intersections illness and disability have in deaths in custody, for example. Mob will say, you know, the death in custody, but I think also looking at the intersections of how illness and disability played into that. And like Tabitha, you were talking about how much incarceration exacerbates illness and how illness leads people to incarceration and cycles of incarceration and hyper-incarceration. I think the fact that that's, it's starting to be more now. I mean, we have this opportunity for this podcast, which is amazing, but that it's taken so long and it's still so little heard. I mean, how have you witnessed it?
I mean, and what we know is that mental institutions or psych wards pipeline our mob into prisons. So, you know, a mob with mental health disorders who might be presenting differently in community, the cops are always called on us. So this kind of idea of community safety is weaponized against black fellas simply being unwell. And then people are put, having to go through court systems. And when you don't present in a way that people might think, quote, way normal, then you don't do well in court either. So you end up in prison, and then when you get to prison, there is no support, there are no Medicare-funded services, and so you remain unwell. And then what's worse is your freedom is then weaponized against you. So if you want to go to the health service within prison and say, look, I'm really struggling mentally, look, I'm down, I'm not coping, I'm anxious, I'm not sleeping, you're then put in solitary. You're not giving care or support. Your conditions are exacerbated by the system. And then even more, you can't speak up about the treatment you're getting by the health service. So medication mismanagement is a critical issue. I was given double the safe legal dose of the medication in prison, which is led to a chronic illness that I now suffer from. And I can't speak up about that because I'm on parole. So if I speak out against the system or I pursue them formally, then my liberty is at risk.
And
the thing for blackfellas in the system is that once we get in there, all of these agencies conspire. So health institutions are absolutely part of the prison industrial complex, as are psych wards and mental institutions. So when I'm out there in community talking about abolition, I'm talking about abolishing all of these things that harm us and inflict violence not only on black minds but black bodies as well.
Exactly, yeah, because... that's the thing. Like when I say I'm angry and devastated because of the ableism with mob, I'm not attacking mob. I'm saying this is a thing the colony uses to separate us. And if you can't acknowledge and work actively to unlearn the ableism from the colony, then how are you ever going to be able to fully create a struggle against them? Because if you're not, that phrase, nothing about us without us.
Yeah.
We're never going to get that if we don't also recognise this. The colony uses ableism and the discrimination of sick and disabled people to separate us. And, I mean, in their imagined world, it works perfectly. Mob feel isolated and alone, and they sit and listen to horrible conversations when the problem is nothing to do with mob, but the fact that there has to be an unlearning and recognition of the fact that this even is a problem.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I'm here today speaking, but that was just luck. I could have very well been dead. I'm just one, and I'm full aware every single day that I'm just one blackfellow alive on luck. that I didn't get killed by the colony, and behind me and around me are all the mob that didn't make it. And a lot of their deaths are never recorded because the hospital, if I may use it, as in Marley's case, they try to get Marley's mum's case.
Yeah.
Yeah. They try to get away with it.
I don't think the system, I mean,
and they're trying to do that with me. They and that's what they do is they can weigh you down. And then you've got non-Aboriginal people saying, oh, but, you know, is it worth it? You need to let it go because, you know, there's this whole thing of if you fight for justice and for what's right, that, you know, you've got to make a choice between that and staying alive. It's almost like it's that cut and dry, you know, and it's like I'm trying to just stay alive right now. But meanwhile, like you said, like if they've lied to me and they've treated me like this and they've caused this kind of negligence, they're doing it to heaps of people and they're getting away with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, 2.5 months I was in a private psychiatric hospital where, you know, this negligence happened that caused my surgery, and they've written complete lies and they treated me exactly as in prison. And it was during Black Lives Matter. Wow. Was it really clear that I was the only Aboriginal person in the whole fucking place? I'm like watching the TV and watching Black Lives Matter, and even the other patients are going, oh, what's that about? Why are you watching that? Like immediately right there, you're just in a completely, you know, non-relatable space.
Because you're forced to.
People that are there. I just felt completely isolated. It was horrible, just horrible. The only nurses who talked to me were the black ones that came from other countries.
Because they understand a bit about what it means to be.
Yeah, we had like little Black Lives Matter debriefs in my hospital room. Yeah. All the black nurses would come in there and we'd all have our debrief about white people, you know. But like, that's a terrible thing to say, but that's how it was.
And I don't think that's kind of...
Oh, no, you go. Sorry.
I was just going to say that's like where the importance of like having other black followers in those spaces are having like Aboriginal healthcare professionals, you know, psychologists. The first time I heard a healthcare professional be like, you're, you know,
why we need our own services. Though, like, I finally was so desperate I called Wanunga and nobody cares, and I don't know what to do. And, you know, since I've become so sick of the, you know, it's like I've lost my whole identity. I don't exist anymore. And and, you know, and then immediately I had a doctor and a nurse from the Aboriginal Medical Service come to my house every week and do my bloods here and check me out because they knew I was too sick to even get to the practice. You know, that was never going to happen with any of the white doctors I went to see or any of the clinics I went to.
And that, I think that's the thing. I mean, like Tabitha was talking about the how illness contributes to being put, the colony driving into incarceration, and then the worsening of illness as a result of incarceration. It's like it's that isolation you get, isolation from the colony, and then lack of acknowledgement within communities as well of how pervasive and how you know, how deep discrimination, particularly within medical spaces, runs. I think because, I mean, for a long time, if you were sick, well, what did you do? And so, you know, there's the ethos. I mean, my nan and my elders, you know, you just get on with it and you don't talk about it because what can you do? What else can you do? And within today's society, we're no longer within the missions and with the limited rations, but we're still facing, like Tabitha was saying, I think that was really powerful about, you know, the sugar has turned into asking for the Ventolin and so on, and the basic medical treatment or even recognition that we are sick. And I mean, against all of that, how can we keep on going when it's no wonder that mob are being trapped by the colony and dying because so little space actually exists.
I actually feel really empowered by the knowledge that we are part of the oldest living culture in the world, you know, and while it may be a steaming pile of shit that we're dealing with,
yes,
we've come this far, like,
yeah,
you know, and it's, I think that's the only way I can continue. Otherwise, it would just be every day, you know, that I'm sure you all know that feeling of just sitting and crying and feeling completely hopeless. But knowing that people who, especially the women in my family, have gone through and they've made it and they've given me the power to express myself and not take it anymore. And they, you know, they survived up until this long. You know, like you were saying before, that disability is not a new thing in our community. So we're still here and we're still going to continue. And I think doing things like this, for me especially, just having that connection with another person that I may never have met before or never even heard of, but then being able to say, I know exactly where you're coming from. And that gives me more and more strength to say, like, you know what it's like when you're the only black fella in a room and you're like, oh, shit. That's what, for me anyway, that's what gets me along, knowing that there's been millions of us that have gotten to this point. So.
Yeah. Tabitha, you were going to say something before, I think, when I was talking.
I was just thinking about the sum of these, you know, this kind of illnesses and disabilities that we have been, like, in our communities since the very first sunrise. But a lot of them were actually brought on by colonisation.
Exactly.
And so we are having to beg for healthcare for diseases that they gave us. And, you know, the irony of that is not lost on us, surely, but, you know, that just perpetuates the struggle that we have every single day in persisting to survive in the colony. You know, it's like the self-living has become an act of radical revolution, and you know, I think that's exhausting. It's exhausting for us to have to face that every day, and it's exhausting for our families and our communities around us. And it's, you know, and then when you're erased from your own spaces, so when we, you know, sometimes about the kind of lack of inclusiveness of our own mob, or when they're putting on events and things like that, about making them accessible. And you know, and when you're asking for things, you always seem to be begging around for stuff, and it just, just impacts. It impacts our own well-being.
Yeah. And then, you know, you go to these disability networks that are already established, but you get there and you realise they're only really for the settlers and particularly the white people of the colony, which it's not, which is something I'm sure we've all come across, but Hannah, you were speaking about it. Do you, if you want to, you can just you don't have to talk about it. When you were talking about wanting to find support, but the inaccessibility of disabled networks that are already established within this colony, because they're mainly for people that aren't us and don't have our experiences and rife with assumptions of what our experiences are.
I mean, Celine, you were talking, you was saying you, that you were in a psych ward where you were like the only black person, you know, there. And I know we're like 3% of the population, so I think they think that by having a single black person there, they're like doing their job with representation. Because that's how it works.
Yeah,
for God.
I think it's... Look, I will say this. I've had chronic pain pretty much. I mean, I assume my entire life. Like, it's gone to the point where it's just... I do not notice it unless it's, like, a really bad day. Or unless you know, I'm on the kind of drugs that take away pain, which is so valid. And the first time I didn't even realize it, actually. I went to an Aboriginal health service and was doing, you know, an hour-long history as a first appointment. And that was literally, the doctor was the first person who had ever said, you know, but doesn't that, like, that looks like it hurts, you know. So I think, I don't know, I don't think the solution is for us to, you know, try to make ourselves more prevalent in systems that are already not working. I think I think that the strength that we have is when we, you know, when mob find each other.
Yes.
And especially when we can, you know, advocate for each other. We can't often, but two people, you know, can get a lot more done than one, like two very tired people can get a lot more done than one healthy person with all the time in the world.
I mean, you've kind of like just naturally kind of summed up like the kind of way where we want to direct this kind of conversation, this kind of yarn, Hannah, is that we we have all these, we have so much struggle and so much pain and so much trauma and so much death weighing us down, and so many difficult things, and trying to find access and space. But I mean, this year myself personally, I found I was really despondent, especially with COVID, because it brought up a lot of new, like a different kind of adaptation of eugenicist language. Why should we, you know, quarantine? Mm-hmm. Because in the beginning it was assumed only the sick people would suffer, already sick people, already different people, and so on. Why should we suffer? And even from some mob who I think just were just not aware of, you know, the vulnerability of sickness, were saying, you know, why do we have to do this? Why can't they just quarantine? As if, you know, a lot of sick mob hadn't already been quarantining, hadn't already been doing that and living in isolated positions for most of their lives, and so on. And I started talking to Marley. I think that's how we initially started talking, was we were bonding about feeling isolated and the ableism of that had been brought about by COVID. And I started to feel hope again because I was able to connect and actually talk with someone. And I think it was the first time I had a really meaningful conversation with other mob about illness and about disability, you know, with mob that actually reflected my experiences. And like you were saying, Hannah, I think that that is one of the most powerful things. It's not, you can't change institutions that, as Tabitha said, are born to cut us to pieces and snuff us out and never listen to us. We can only change things through speaking. And I think of all the younger mob who've never really been able to speak in a big group of lots of other mob like them who have disabilities or illnesses, or yarn about and have get back similar experiences with the violence of the medical complex and the medical system, how much strength and support that would bring. I mean, I've found I've been able to go on this year despite everything that's happened and nearly being killed by the medical system twice within the 1 year and, you know, trying to do all the other things life expects of you. I found the ability to go on because I've been able to talk and connect. And even this show was, I think the idea emerged in May or June, I can't remember when, but whenever it emerged, it just started giving me hope. I started thinking of all the mob I could get to talk and the promises we could produce just from one yarn alone, because we've had so little chance to even have that one yarn and all the other yarns that could emerge from that. So, I mean, I guess I'm trying to say, like, what kind of visions do you hold and kind of hopes do you have for a space and futures in which, you know, mob like us and all of our experiences, not just parts of our experiences, are all actively considered and held as important and the kind of things we want to produce. Samia?
So I didn't really know I was going to be doing this this afternoon and had just got home from literally from rehab. And just doing this has just made a huge difference, you know, and I think that's the thing. It is what we're talking about. It's like connection. Exactly. Connections are broken. We're sick, whether it's spiritually or, you know, like I can't leave the house, I can't drive, I can't do anything, like, you know, months and months. But I can go outside and I can listen to the birds and I've got a nice tree I can sit under, and, like, that's my country right now. That's the only thing, you know. But in terms of people, I've been extremely isolated and lonely and, like, despairing and hopeless. And so just having this conversation is like, oh, I'm not alone. Other people are going through this as well. And, you know, there's similarities and differences. And I don't know, I think coming from the kind of thinking I could make a change by being, you know, in the system has been soul destroying. And the only people who survive in those systems are people who become co-opted into it. You know, if you keep trying to make change, like I have, and be on the ground and actually impact people, you get awards for teaching, but they don't really like you, and you don't really, you know, get any kind of reward for it, and you're kind of difficult and you have to fight the whole time, and it burns you out, you know. So I think this is the only way to go. More and more we have to go back to, like, community, making our own community, making our own connections, supporting each other, holding each other up, you know, like being what we need for each other, because no one else is going to do it.
Exactly. And I mean, the idea of the podcast being in the form of just a yarn, a casual yarn, to me was so important, because, I mean, I had the privilege of being raised in culture, and growing up there was nothing more powerful than what was produced from having a yarn. And listening to the things my aunties would say, just talking, you know, just talking to each other. And, you know, I thought of all, with Marley's help, we thought of all different ways, you know, how could we do this and best produce something that was really good. But the idea of the yarn, it was just the best thing, because just by talking and just by sharing, I mean, like you were saying, Samia, I feel sort of healed from even having to go into the hospital this morning, because having to even be in that space, I felt after I left, I just felt so panicked and stressed and miserable. And this yarn alone has done the world of good for what has been a horrific year of trying to stay alive when the medical system was doing its best to kill me.
Yep.
You did it. Yep. I told you
we're still here.
That's, we are. I completely agree. I think that's where our power is.
Yeah, I'm Eleanor MacDonald. This yarn went for longer than the one you've just heard on the broadcast today. You can listen to the full yarn on 3CR's Disability Day 2020 website. And I'm thankful to the Wurundjeri country for watching over me while I've produced this and spoken and existed within many medical spaces, and for caring for those who have passed on, all countries and nations around this colony who have looked over and care for those who have passed on within horrific medical institutions and horrible circumstances. I think that's very important, and I always hold them within my thoughts and hold respect to those who have passed on and the countries within which they now exist. as old people and ancestors. Thank you for listening. It's been amazing. Mob dreaming up, yarning sick, disabled realities. Let's hear more of it in the future because we need it. So thank you.